Reynolds, Journalism Institute of the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Think about this for a moment. Might your children or grandchildren someday live in a world without rhinoceroses or African elephants? The chances of that are probably higher than you might guess. A mammoth aerial census of savanna elephants in Africa released last year found only about 350,000 left, about one-tenth the number in 1900. Worse, the population is shrinking by about 27,000 a year. As for rhinos, their numbers have bounced back in some parts of Africa after the species was nearly wiped out, but there are still only about 5,000 black rhinos in the wild, down from about 65,000 in 1970. The culprit, of course, is poachers. And today on Global Journalist, we're going to talk about the trade in wildlife goods like elephant tusks and rhino horns, and why these species are still under threat despite decades of advocacy from environmental groups. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a panel of experts on different aspects of this trade. But first, we're going to talk to Jeremy Young. He's a senior producer for Al Jazeera in Washington, where he made a recent undercover documentary called The Poacher's Pipeline about the networks of people that profit off the trade in rhino horn. Jeremy, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So you spent months working on this documentary, and you had teams of people going undercover and tracking the trade in rhino horn from South Africa to Southeast Asia. Give us just sort of like a brief overview of what you found.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of work done that's very interesting that deals with the actual poachers who go into the park and kill the animals and move the products out of the park. There's been a lot of interesting undercover stuff done in places like Vietnam and China, where people go undercover to purchase these products at the end of the supply chain. But what we wanted to do was expose the criminals who are at the center of the supply chain, level three, level four criminals who are moving these products from places like South Africa and Mozambique to countries like Vietnam and China. And they've got the cash to orchestrate this. They've got connections at airports and border crossings. They've got the wherewithal to really make this trade happen, and that's who we wanted to focus our energy on.
And so tell me, how were you able to penetrate these groups? I mean, it sounds like they're like mafia groups.
It's funny. We actually thought this was going to be an environmental project, an environmental investigation, and what it turned out was something that was much more akin to focusing on organized crime. A lot of the individuals were involved in the trade or affiliated with major gangs like the Triads and other organized crime syndicates based out of Southeast Asia. What was essential for us was working with several Chinese investigators who were willing to go undercover on our behalf, posing as business people interested in the trade to learn how they could become involved and learn sort of what the techniques and the tactics are for evading the authorities.
Well, we're going to listen to just a clip from the Poacher's Pipeline now that I think speaks to why this trade persists, even in a place like South Africa, in spite of efforts of game rangers and others.
It's not the rangers that are going to make the ultimate difference between the survival of the rhino or not. It's whether we address the organized criminal syndicates.
Organized crime can only flourish in a corrupt environment. And until we can fix our corruption here, we will never, ever stop the poaching.
So, Jeremy, what did you find about the reach of corruption in South Africa?
Well, it's endemic. I mean, corruption, political corruption in particular, is a major problem. But the ability of the organized criminal syndicates to be able to bribe park rangers, to be able to bribe customs officials, to be able to bribe people at airports and border crossings to get these products through. I mean, it's a really, really a big problem. I mean, another sort of thing that came about throughout our investigation that we learned a lot more about was the involvement of embassies and the involvement of diplomats in moving these products from Africa to Asia.
The involvement of diplomats, like diplomats from where?
So there's been a number of embassies that have been linked to wildlife trafficking, in particular. China, Vietnam, and North Korea have all been linked in different types of incidents. You've got to remember that diplomats can move products in diplomatic pouches, which are often not searched by law enforcement and other border people. This product is something that caters to a very upper crust of society in a lot of these countries. It's a status symbol. So wealthy people who travel abroad want to bring something back that shows that they're part of this elite caste within their society.
And one of the things that you found, you went undercover, and I guess your investigator was speaking to one of these middlemen, and he said that he had sort of connections with a senior official in the South African government. What did you learn?
Yeah, we were able to introduce our undercover investigator to a level three trafficker who was based in eastern South Africa. He runs a business, very common in these types of settings. He runs a nail salon, a massage parlor, which later turned out to also be a brothel. A lot of these criminals are also involved in human trafficking and sex trafficking as well. But he was able to produce for us a photograph with him and the Minister of State Security for South Africa. You know, he claimed that this minister was someone who he could count on as a contact in case they needed him for anything.
And the Minister for State Security, of course, has denied those allegations then.
It's interesting what's happened. I mean, there's a number of photos have surfaced of the State Security Minister in this massage parlor. So he hasn't been able to deny that that was a business that he used to frequent. He said he used to go there to get his nails done, but he had no idea that the man who was running the place was involved in rhino horn trafficking. And then more recently, the South African police have come out to say that their investigation has revealed that it's also a brothel. So, you know, these things are demonstrable facts, and it's a big problem because the Minister of State Security oversees an institution in South Africa responsible for investigating national security, but also investigating organized crime. So if the minister who runs that department is unaware that a rhino horn trafficker is running his favorite salon, that's a big problem.
And we're going to hear another clip now from the Poachers Pipeline from a source discussing some of the difficulties in prosecuting sort of the downstream people involved in this trade.
These are organized crime syndicates, but the challenge is these people, you don't find them in the park, you don't find them with firearms, you don't find them with their rhino horn. You find someone is sitting in Vietnam or in China. What are the chances that you can link that person to a rhino that has been killed in Kruger National Park? The chances are very slim.
So tell us, how come law enforcement internationally isn't able to make that link between a rhino horn in Southeast Asia and a dead rhino in South Africa?
Well, it's hard. I mean, they're trying. I mean, they do investigations, crime scene investigations every time a rhino is killed. But remember, in Kruger National Park, Jason, 2 to 3 rhino are killed every single night. I mean, it's a massive amount of animals that are being killed. What we did for our investigation in order to connect these chains was the level three trafficker based in South Africa connected us to a level four trafficker who was based in Southeast China. And we actually traveled there and arranged a purchase. We didn't go through with the buy, but we arranged to meet his contact who produced a genuine rhino horn for us. So we were able to prove the connection between the level three in South Africa and the level four criminal in China.
And there was sort of a big reveal as part of your reporting in this, and our time does grow short here, but you uncovered some evidence that there were senior officials in the Chinese government that are actually involved in this trade.
Yeah, and it's not the first time that an allegation like this has surfaced. When presidents travel from countries like Vietnam and China, they bring along a huge number of people who are part of that trip for different reasons. A lot of those individuals, again, as I explained, are part of an elite caste of society, and they want to return with something that they can show to friends and family that reveals their status. And in these situations, there's been a big run on ivory products, rhino horn, and other wildlife products that are illegal.
Jeremy Young, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the trade in wildlife goods like elephant and rhino horns that has decimated the population of these animals in Africa. Now, a recent announcement by the Chinese government has raised hopes that demand for elephant tusks will soon be curtailed. We're going to hear more about that and other aspects of this trade from three other people who follow the business of poaching closely. Joining us from Yarmouth Port, Massachusetts, is Grace Gabriel. She's the Asia Regional Director for the International Fund for Animal Welfare. In London is Isabel Hilton. She's a contributor to The Guardian and the editor-in-chief of ChinaDialogue.net, a news site about environmental issues in China. Now, also in London is Aaron White. He's a campaigner for the Environmental Investigation Agency, a group that researches environmental crimes. Now, welcome to all of you. Grace Gabriel, let me start with you. Just tell us, if you would, where is the main demand for ivory? Where does it come from, and why is it that people want it?
I think the when we talk about addressing wildlife crime, we really need to look at the entire trade chain, from poaching to trafficking to trading to buying. And unfortunately, with the economic growth and also lack of laws and unclear laws and allowing legal markets for elephant ivory to exist in many parts of the Asian continent, prompted or stimulated a demand that ivory has always been regarded as a status symbol in Chinese society or in many Asian societies, but the legal market in China, particularly in the last that opened in 10 years ago, made a trickle of demand for elephant ivory into a flood.
So, Aaron White, if you could just pick up on that point, the trade in elephant tusks and ivory was banned worldwide in 1989. Bring us up to speed. What's happened since then?
In 2008, CITES, which is an international agreement between many different countries in the world, they allowed a one-off sale of ivory to Japan and China. This followed a similar sale in 1999, which went to Japan only. And this enabled China to set up a system of legal trade in ivory. This was done through establishing a licensing system for processing facilities and also sales facilities. But EIA investigations in China repeatedly found that this system was hugely flawed. The existence of a legal trade in ivory stimulated demand by legitimizing the product in the eyes of the consumers and also provided massive opportunities for laundering illegal ivory. And traders told EIA investigators repeatedly in China that they estimated up to 90% of ivory on the market was actually from illegal sources.
So in other words, what you're saying is that after this initial ban on ivory worldwide, like demand for it fell, it became sort of a taboo thing to have. But then after there were a couple little spurts where there were two sales that were legalized, this sort of maybe diminished that taboo and then allowed the illegal trade, the black market trade, to flourish. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. Grace?
If you want to pick up on that point.
Yeah, it's exactly the in 1989, to stem poaching crisis, CITES banned international trade in ivory. And after that ban, prices dropped, markets collapsed, and that reduced incentives for poaching. And that allowed elephants to recover on the African continent. But the trade in 1999 to Japan and 2008 to China and Japan basically damaged the integrity of the CITES trade ban and created enforcement difficulties. In addition to what Aaron talked about, remove stigma attached with ivory and also created ways for criminals to launder illegal ivory. It created huge enforcement difficulties. Enforcement officers are not able to tell once illegal ivory gets on the market whether it's illegal or legal.
And I wanted to ask you, Aaron White, about sort of public opinion in China. I saw that National Geographic recently had a poll out of Chinese people. It showed that something like 79% of people in China supported a ban on ivory, but only maybe about a third felt like the government could enforce its own rules on it. What does that tell us?
I think that it tells us that increasingly in China, public opinion is on the side of the world's wildlife. Increasingly, people in China want to see strong enforcement, strong legislation to protect wildlife, as they are recognizing this is this level of consumption of wildlife products. It's anachronistic and it's damaging China's reputation and worldwide. Another interesting point in that survey found that a significant number of people who currently are interested in purchasing ivory would not do so if they if ivory was entirely illegal, which really supports the importance of a blanket ban on commercial trade in ivory, as it sends a clear message that the consumption of ivory is no longer acceptable.
Well, let me bring in Isabel Hilton then. Isabel, if you could speak to why is it that you think China is moving now to towards sort of a blanket ban on ivory? Was there something in particular that spurred this change?
Well, I think that, you know, we are at a critical, such a critical point in terms of elephant populations. And you know, as has been pointed out, the big boom in consumption followed the lifting of the ban in 2008. So China is in a position now where it is very easy to point the finger at China and say, you know, basically, if the elephants disappear, it's China's failure to enforce its ban and its failure to police the smuggling and its failure to discourage consumption. And there's really nothing in it for China to be the country that killed off the elephants. So I think that finally the message is getting through that this is going to be laid at China's door. And we've been publishing a series this year in with the Guardian newspaper in Chinese in China on the fate of the elephant and the plight of the elephant. And it's had fantastic pickup. So I really agree with the sense that China's public is beginning to understand that this matters and that we are at a critical point. And then maybe a possibility of shifting public attitudes to ivory and turning it back into a taboo.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Isabel, if I could just continue in this vein. Something like rhino horn has been banned for quite some time, and yet it hasn't diminished demand. And yet also for things like illegal drugs, we've seen that blanket bans haven't curtailed demand. So why is it that it may work for ivory?
Well, because I think that the gift-giving aspect, the status aspect, the display aspect is bigger with ivory. You know, the kind of the excuse before the Chinese declared their complete ban in December, there was a lot of argument about, you know, the industry associated with carving, the kind of traditional art and craft aspect of it, and the prestige attached to it. But if gift-giving really can't accommodate ivory anymore, then that diminishes a lot of its value. With rhino horn, I think its place in things like traditional Chinese medicine is strong, and the attachment of traditional Chinese medicine to various body parts of endangered species is problematic. It has, you know, no medicinal value, but it has high symbolic value. And I think that traditional Chinese medicine is probably the next area that we really need to put pressure on. But also it's a matter of enforcement. You know, as long as there is a market, and in rhino horn there is a big market in terms of TCM, then you know, that makes it much harder. And Chinese enforcement has always been on the patchy side, to put it mildly.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. Today we're talking about the business of animal poaching and the trade in goods like elephant tusks. We're joined by Grace Gabriel of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, Isabel Hilton of the environmental news site China Dialogue, and Aaron White of the Environmental Investigation Agency. For more Global Journalist, you can visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you can find our ongoing coverage of underreported international issues. You can also check out Global Journalist on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. And Grace Gabriel, I wanted to turn it to you then and ask you about the role of criminal syndicates in this. What about this trade is appealing to them? If your group is already involved in activities like drugs or human trafficking, what's sort of the business rationale for getting involved in the trade in endangered species goods?
Well, unfortunately, because of the low priority put on by all of the governments around the world put on the environment crime. So this crime has become a high profit, low risk endeavor. I had an opportunity one time to ask a current trader whether he would shift to other types of crime. And he says no, because one shipment of ivory, even if it gets confiscated, my next shipment is going to make all that profit back. And then I'm able to use that profit to grease the palms of officers, enforcement officers along the entire trade chain. So criminal syndicates are attracted to wildlife crime because it's high profit, low risk. And then the proceeds from this crime, they're going to be able to use it to fund other types of violent crime.
And Aaron White of the Environmental Investigation Agency, we've talked a bit about the role of China as sort of the major market for ivory, for elephant tusks. Tell us just a little bit about how other countries are involved. I mean, just a couple of years ago, there was a lot of media attention in the U.S. when a dentist from Minnesota killed Zimbabwe's most famous lion. This lion called Cecil the Lion was sort of lured out of the park and killed in Zimbabwe. But is there a significant involvement of other countries in this trade besides just the origin countries and the demand countries?
There is, absolutely. I think, first of all, it's important to point out that China has very recently announced that it's closing its domestic markets, its retail markets for ivory, which is a hugely positive step.
And these are the functioning legal markets then?
Yeah. So the registered retail and processing facilities will no longer be able to process and sell ivory. The first batch is closing down just in March this year. So that's a hugely positive step and is to be commended.
And these are the markets where illegal ivory was sort of bleeding into sort of the quote-unquote legal supply chain then.
Yeah, so that's potentially is a major loophole that is severely restricted, but we are keeping a close eye on the specific language of that ban, as it does appear to allow some limited auction of what's termed as cultural artifacts, but what they will represent, whether these will be restricted to antiques, how this will be regulated has not yet been announced. So we hope to see a full end to the commercial trade in ivory, and that any auctions are very limited in number and are restricted to, for example, non-commercial institutions such as museums.
And Isabel Hilton, if I could just turn this to you then, looking forward over the next 2 to 3 years, we've heard about some of the difficulties in ending this trade. What are some steps that the international community can take to get a handle on this issue?
Well, I think that, you know, China is not the only country that has had ivory trade. China has announced a complete ban. The UK has not. There are other countries where the trade in antique ivory, for instance, is permitted. And this obviously invites, as we've discussed, invites a confusion and a mixing of new ivory in business. And I think that it's now, given that China has taken this radical step, it's now up to other countries to match it. The other issue is enforcement and also the protection of local communities, because, you know, one of the questions around enforcement is how do you help people who are on the front line, who are dealing with poachers, who are dealing with elephants, which are not entirely benign if you live next door to them? You know, how do you help people to protect and value elephants? How do you ensure that they also benefit from keeping elephants alive more than from seeing them dead?
Well, this is a very interesting question. You know, like in the case of rhinoceroses, in the Al Jazeera documentary, they said that a single rhinoceros horn had the same value as a park ranger's, the amount of money he could earn over his entire life. So at some point you wonder, like, how can you ever solve this problem when the value of these goods is so great?
Well, it's pretty tough, and it's also, I think we really have to acknowledge that an elephant trampling your crops is not great if that's all you've got. So, but there are models in which local communities are, you know, benefit from the benign aspect of preserving elephants, which is greater tourism and you know, the benefits that can bring. And you know, violence, a diminution of violence, because this kind of poaching does kill people. So I think that support for them, support in enforcement at that level, but also an insistence that, for instance, in China, where enforcement of all manner of laws is a bit hit and miss, that to hold China to account for if smuggling routes continue, particularly through Vietnam, through that southwest corridor, and if the traffic does continue, you know, just to keep holding it to account.
And Grace Gabriel, if I could turn it to you too, looking forward, I thought one of the things that was interesting in the Poacher's Pipeline undercover documentary was that there was this village in Vietnam where endangered wildlife goods had been sold quite openly. There were literally stores with signs that said ivory, rhino horn, tiger meat. But it seems like that trade has evolved and moved in some ways online. What sorts of platforms are the people who are selling this stuff? What are they using?
Many countries actually in Asia, we have seen that criminals have moved their trade online because they can target their consumer base a lot quicker, faster, easier. And so that's also one of the areas we have been working with with China's online marketplaces. As early as 2008, China's the largest online marketplace, Alibaba and Taobao in Chinese, which means treasure hunt, have banned many endangered species from tiger bone, rhino horn, bear bile, elephant ivory to shark fin. And by making marketplaces unavailable for trade, we have found it helps reduce, combined with enforcement and then penalties, helps basically stigmatize wildlife consumption. And that stigmatization is so important. It helps reduce demand for endangered species.
Well, Aaron White, let me just turn this to you because our time does grow short. One of the novel ways to sort of cut the demand for ivory has been to substitute woolly mammoth tusks. Can you just tell us briefly about that effort and some of the issues it raises?
There's an increasing amount of mammoth ivory is accessible in the in Siberia, and increasing amounts of that are being taken to China and used as an alternative carving tool. Now, there are a number of issues around this. Firstly, as an extinct species, the mammoth isn't covered under the international agreements that regulate trade in wildlife. And so it's difficult to regulate, and it's also a major concern is that elephant ivory could be passed off as mammoth ivory. This would present a real challenge for enforcement, as the two different materials are very difficult to tell apart, especially in the in a carved state. And this is an area of concern that is growing.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Jeremy Young, Grace Gabriel, Isabel Hilton, and Aaron White. Our lead producer this week is Rachel Foster Gimbel. Assistant producers are Lauren Donovan, Dewey Sim, and Idom Kasey Galan. Our visual editor is Alyssa Blyle, with multimedia production from Jonah McCown. Pat Akers is our audio engineer, and our director is Travis McMillan. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.